Okay, so Half-Life Alyx, of course you've probably all read about it already, is the very latest installment in the Half-Life series, bringing it triumphantly into a VR realm after a few years of being a little bit quiet on the Half-Life front, and it's already being hailed as one of the very best, if not the best, VR game of all time. The reviews are ridiculous. And luckily I'm joined today by composer Mike Muraski to talk a little bit about his work on this game and audio in a VR realm. So hello, welcome on again, Mike. I think it's the third time.
Yeah, hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Yourself?
As well as can be expected, I think, given the circumstances, yeah.
I think we're all giving very similar answers in this time.
Yeah, I'm pretty big on woodshedding, so I just saw a really funny article the other day my wife showed me about Gen Xers. You know, I'm right at the edge, but I refuse to be a boomer because that's my parents' generation. I don't really buy into the fact that I would be in that zone, but we Gen Xers are definitely more than happy to just hang out inside and read a lot of comic books and not do much of anything, and so I'm perfectly comfortable, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've already said on my show that the biggest change for me is just that certain things aren't available at the shop anymore.
Right. Amazon takes longer, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Not to play down the suffering and whatnot that's going on everywhere, because I definitely am feeling that, you know.
Of course, we all are. But I guess that's the whole point of me trying to continue on with this show throughout this time as well, is that a little bit of distraction for everybody. So I'm sure everyone's eager to hear about this new Half-Life.
Yeah, we just barely got it out. We actually shipped it over Zoom. You know, so
right.
It was a really unique experience for us, even, you know.
And that is right up to date, because I actually only heard of Zoom for the first time last week when some friends got in touch with me about it.
Yeah, I think when the day we shipped it was, or the day before, I think we tested it. But it was the first time I'd used it ever, you know. So, yeah.
I believe this was your first game working on VR as well.
Yeah, I helped out with the lab a little bit, but I wasn't a key player. I was working on something else at the time, so I just did some music for it, and I spent a lot of time with Emily and others on kind of what audio and VR means, and what, you know, because there was a lot of hype as soon as VR showed up, you know, every binaural scientist on the planet was reaching out and looking for big, you know, business deals and whatnot. And so we spent a whole bunch of time sort of investigating what the current state of the tech was at the time, and sort of, you know, trying to get through the hype and figure out, you know. Also, we had all the kind of hardware guys asking us for big new groundbreaking solutions, and so there was sort of this two-part education process going on, where we were trying to educate ourselves about what audio and VR meant, and then also educate the hardware guys, because they weren't even really aware of what audio in games already was, and they're really not very different, to be quite honest. But we've come a long way since then. So I spent quite a bit of effort early on with Emily, you know, sorting through all the different technologies and helping her, with the direction we were going to go with the headphones that ended up being the Hummingbirds that are just so fantastic, you know. But yeah, this is the first real VR game that I've worked on, you know.
Well, it's interesting. This is a conversation I've definitely been looking forward to, because, I mean, relatively, VR is still a kind of new thing, and a lot of people out there still don't have it, myself included, just haven't been able to afford it yet over the years. So I've been watching footage of Half-Life Alyx instead. But in that case, that means I don't, although I've had all these years of knowledge with video game music, I still don't really know the ways that audio applies into VR. So it's definitely something I wanted to pick your brains on.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's we're barely scratching the surface. There's, so much to be explored there. It's pretty fascinating, actually.
Well, one thing I noticed through playthroughs, just to jump into it, is it seemed straight up to me, because this was one of the very first times I've dipped into VR and spent significant time, well, just watching a VR video. It seemed to me that the biggest audio applications for VR is in things like sound design and actual sound effects. And strangely enough, the music should actually, or it seemed to, stay pretty straight in the stereo field rather than doing loads of crazy panning things. And is that like because it would actually be kind of weird if the music was jumping around all over the place?
That's a really good observation. And it took me a while to get to that place. Ironically, basically when I joined the team, which is, I guess, about 3 years ago, something like that, Dave Fiza had already been working on it for about a year or so and was doing some really, and this stuff remains in the game. I mean, one of my very favorite parts of the audio in the game is his soundscapes and the way he handles audio and is using our tool set to really push the envelope on spatialization and sounds moving around you. And, you know, really, he really took it to nth degree. And that stuff was really effective super early on. And so I jumped in and started using some of his tools and writing some of my own tool sets for, you know, all kinds of crazy ideas on ways to use spatialization and sort of our advanced, really open tool set to push the outer bounds of that stuff. And what I slowly but surely found, I mean, there were so many moving parts on this project that it was sort of hard to really assess at any given point until, let's say, about a year ago or a little bit more. What was the right answer for any of this stuff. But one thing I slowly but surely did find was that if, you know, because there were a lot of opinions really early on, like music should only come out of a radio. You know what I mean? It should only be in the, you know, sourced in the game, that sort of thing. And I definitely knew that wasn't going to work. Having done a lot of spatial music in Left 4 Dead and Portal 2, that was seemed like the obvious go-to for me. But the more I did it, the more it did feel really weird. You know, it was really like, wait, why is the music coming from over there? Or why is there's this music moving around me or whatever? And I slowly but surely ended up moving it way more towards just the standard diegetic style thing where, you know, or, you know, non-diegetic words, it's basically, it's a message from the art. You know what I mean? Like it's not coming from the game at all. It's coming from the art of the game or the sort of meta message of the game. And that seemed to work. People accepted that really quickly, you know? And it took me a long time just to even figure out that people would accept music as they would in a film, you know, or a video game for that matter. But it's interesting that the heavily spatialized sort of approach was not something that I made work in this particular context. I think there are contexts where you could make it work really well, but, you know, Half-Life has always been a very sort of cinematic, story-driven experience. And so what I found is that if you really pushed sort of those game style interactive techniques, it made it feel gamey, a little bit arcade-like, you know? And so I do think that there are probably experiences or styles of VR gameplay where you could do that, and it would probably be super awesome. In this particular case, I found that in most cases, that was not what I wanted to do. I mean, I definitely found, you know, Kelly Bailey's work on the original games was so spectacular in the way that the music sort of played this, it like laid out a canvas for the sound design to sort of play around on top of it. And often felt like the drones of the city were the music, and those things kind of easily handed their front role back and forth. And so I was always looking for opportunities to do that more explicitly, I guess, you know? And so there's definitely parts of the game where, you know, there's sound design that's actually, I consider, more music. You know, it's really skirting the line. And those things are very spatial, but they're very explicitly coming, usually explicitly coming from something in the world, you know?
Yeah, and I actually sense that, I mean, mostly probably because of the extensive conversation we'd had in the past about Portal and things like that, in which there are similar ideas going on. Like, it reminds me of the aerial faith plate we talked about, where it's, we discussed, like, where is that coming from in the world kind of thing, and players just kind of have to accept that. And you also mentioned Kelly Bailey, which is funny because we've jumped into the VR stuff straight away, but of course I wanted to bring up straight away that Half-Life is, of course, beloved for Kelly Bailey's music over the years. And although you have kind of followed on from his stuff in the past with Portal, how did it feel to come into that, and how beholden did you feel to what came before?
Oh, I mean, it was really difficult, to be totally honest. Like, I found this project really, really tricky. But, you know, not just... like I said, there were a lot of moving parts. We were basically beta testers for the hardware team. So, you know, I spent entire days where I was trying to work on music or audio or tools or whatever. But instead I was plugging and unplugging USB cables from my computer, you know, literally all day long. That mixed with the entire team was, you know, struggling with sort of where the story was going to go and what we wanted the tone of the game to be and all those things. And so that mixed with basically kind of trying to look at, you know, I'm super familiar with Kelly's work. We're friends. We work together on other projects, and he and I are both, you know, pretty long-winded. So we would spend many an evening till really early hours in the morning just talking about whatever projects we were working on and whatnot. So I'm pretty familiar with his mentality around how he works and whatnot, but it's still pretty daunting. Like, you know, those games are absolutely legendary, and his work in them is really spectacular. I mean, I view that his work and his position in the industry is a huge influence on everything I've done, let alone coming into this, you know, an extension of the products that he made really famous. And so, yeah, it was tricky, you know, from that standpoint. But I tried not to dwell on it too much. I mean, I've listened to every piece of music in all four of those games ad nauseum. Like, I have listened to those soundtracks thousands and thousands of times at this point, analyzed all of the modes and scales and instruments he was using. But what I found was that trying to mimic him really wasn't working for me, because, if you look at those games really, and if you know the people who worked on them, what you'll find is that one of the reasons they're so, so good is that they have these really strong voices, you know, artistic voices in them. I don't know if you've ever, like, you know, there are definitely some, like, let's say if you were to pick up a guitar and try and be Angus Young, you know, his voice style is so clear that there are some sort of almost, stereotypical things you can do that'll make you sound like him, but you would really need to spend a whole bunch of time, you know, sort of embodying his style and rhythm techniques and whatnot. And when you look at the Half-Life art and the style of gameplay and the storylines and the tone and in Kelly's music, it's very, you know, it's very much Kelly, right? So what I ended up doing is sort of trying to embody as much of sort of his, the things that I could sort of quantify, you know, and nail down, and then sort of try and bring my own voice to it in a similar way, but with a giant nod to to the originals so that there would hopefully be enough of a through thread for people to accept it and for it to fit. But that's the other thing, is the game is different. It's also set in a different time frame. You're playing as Alex, so there's that difference. And then we have a whole bunch of artists and new developers and whatnot adding their voice to the whole thing. So ultimately, you know, I mean, I'm a very holistic, when I work on these on any project, I'm super holistic and try to best complement the product that I can. And really my concerns about music and, you know, my art are always secondary to that greater goal. And so, you know, all those things kind of melded together, and I tried to make sure that I had at least, you know, two or three key sort of variables that would identify as, that I would identify as, you know, Kelly's techniques involved in every piece of music, even though the music might be very different than something that, you know, showed up in any of his projects, you know?
So, funnily enough, another thing that I wanted to talk about before we might actually get into some of the nitty-grittiness behind the actual composition and things like that is that Half-Life, I think, as opposed to something like Portal, which we've spoken about before, is a lot more musically silent. Like, I felt like music was a lot more constant in the background in Portal, whereas Half-Life, it seems a lot more sparing. And strangely enough, musical silence is something I've gotten really interested in recently and have started speaking about on my show quite a lot. So when do you make the decisions on when music is appropriate, and even ambiences? Because at times it can go from outright silence into an ambience in the background. So when do you decide when something's appropriate?
Well, you know, Valve, as you're probably aware, is what we call a flat company. You know, nobody's in charge. There's no director on the game or single visionary. You know, Robin Walker did a fantastic job spearheading the idea in the first place and then holding it together and kind of keeping everybody on more or less the same page and you know, keeping the dark visions of doubt and whatnot at bay as best as possible. But still, you know, we all sort of come together and collaborate together and then watch, you know, we do a ton of play testing and whatnot. And that's sort of how our games come together. And it's the process that we know and trust and has worked for us, you know, numerous times in the past. And sound is no different. You know, the team, like I said, started out with Dave Fiza and Roland Shaw and myself, and Kelly Thornton, and then Emily Ridgway joined in, and so the five of us, you know, were working together, and it's interesting how these things sort of play out, because it tends to be fairly organic. You know, we would have lunch, you know, on a really regular basis, if not every day, and sort of just talk about the game in general, but as we would go. You know, I would basically, I mean, there's a couple different things from the standpoint of music in the game. And especially I was super aware of how Half-Life was very sparing in the music. And then the music was, like I said, purposely sort of this open canvas that, like, if you look at the, you know, the Strider battle in Half-Life 2, the latter one, the rooftop Strider battle, you know, the music is wonderful, but it is really quite simple. But then the sound design of the Strider, like, danced on top of the music in such a way that was really spectacular, you know? And part of that's because Kelly did everything, right? Like, he did all the music and all the sound design. But we were trying to be as aware of that sort of thing as possible. But then you have this, you know, element of VR thrown into it. And I did some tests early on, so like 2.5 years ago or whatever. And admittedly, I think my tests were flawed, but it was early enough that, you know, I would put different types of music in the game just in places. And man, the opinions coming out of the people that I was testing on, meaning my colleagues, were really strong. And many of them were very anti-music, to be totally honest. You know, like that, it totally brings me out of the immersion of the game, so on and so forth. And, you know, VR was super new to everybody. So, you know, I kind of took that all very seriously. And it took me quite a while to figure out. There was a couple of spots in the game where it was supposed to get exciting, you know, like when the alarm first goes off, you're in the laundry room and the alarm goes off and basically you're supposed to kind of move on, basically, you know, and the combine are running around and whatnot. And people were not really paying attention to the alarm or to the excitement at all. Like they would be, you know, futzing with the laundromat and just playing around, which some people still do, which is fine. But from a sort of cinematic and storytelling standpoint, it just wasn't moving. And so I tried sneaking some kind of pulse, classic cinema pulse music in the background. And lo and behold, playtest people just were like, oh, I got to go. Like, there's something happening. I need to move, right? And I saw slowly but surely, and I knew this, and I was verbalizing it, the idea that we're not actually making reality, we're making entertainment. And so putting music in that form makes a lot of sense. And people started to notice it and going, oh my God, that's great. Actually, that really helps. It, you know, serves a function from a game standpoint, from a pacing standpoint. And I've seen this in other games too, where as you get things in, you put things in a successful fashion, which sort of requires the rest of the game to be functioning in the way that it should be, that people start asking for more of that same function in other places, right? And so so anyway, I know I tend to go on about, you know, basically what you're asking, but over time, the request for music went from basically like, don't put music in, it makes it too scary, which definitely I got some of in the early days. B, it removes the immersion or it takes me out of the location, to, you know, fast forward to the end, to where I think there was a lot of level designers that would have liked to have music in more places. But so, you know, if you look at that as the sort of overall arc of where the viewpoint, my personal viewpoint from testing and watching playtesters and then working with all of my colleagues, like it sort of progressed from basically almost no music to, you know, the desire for there to be a lot. But then on top of it, you know, I'm always looking at where's, you know, there's a big moment here. Is the sound design going to be really big? You know, because I sort of helped to organize our system. Like I said, our tools are super open. And so I helped to organize sort of our signal flow and our levels and whatnot. And really with the desire to be able to have a really large dynamic range and make things seem really large, because in VR, scale is such a big deal. And so anyway, with that all in mind, I kind of started just looking for A, opportunities, B, but sort of like, I made a giant spreadsheet and tried to spread it out so that it represented sort of the overall time of the game and the things that were happening in the game, and then made sure that the music, that there were no giant deserts, you know, big like spaces that went on for too long without some music. And then also look for spots where music could help to move it forward. And then the obvious ones where it's like, oh, there's something happening here. Is there something we can do with music to make it more impactful? You know, because that's really, especially I found in VR, it really is, you know, it's just sort of like film or whatever, games, same thing. But it's even more powerful in, especially if you give some silence, if you let there be some space without music, then when it does come in, it, you know, adds a lot more impact to the emotion and the feeling of the experience, as well as, you know, and the interesting thing is, and none of us necessarily knew this, I mean, I did play a ton of VR, similar style VR titles before and during this process, but music does slip into the background often, just as much as it would in a game or in a film, maybe even more so than a game, but more like a film when you're really engaged in some experience. And so it can kind of move into the background of your consciousness and just really affect how you feel about it while you're focused on defeating the antlions or whatever, you know.
Well, there are some key moments where I feel like it could potentially really get in the way. Like, particularly for me, the very opening section was really interesting to me as someone who's barely played VR. I think I've spent about 15 minutes with a VR headset on in the past. And I was, because you're almost presented with this kind of like mini playground of different things you can play with in Half-Life Alyx. And this very opening time when you first got control, you know, like cans you can crush, bottles you can throw, things like that. And you want to hear those sounds. You want that feedback when you crushed a can for the first time. And particularly what blew me away when I was watching this video was the guy who was playing it decided to just throw one of the bottles as far away as he could. And it just landed and smashed on this other building off in the distance. And I thought that was incredible. And music could easily cover that up. But also because you say you've been working a little bit on those systems, I was interested in how something that realistic is achieved, because my knowledge goes about as far as left and right panning and using reverb to maybe distance it a little bit. But that's as far as my knowledge goes.
Right. Well, you know, the opening, there's sort of two conversations to be had there, but the opening was a really interesting one because we had played with that, the reveal of the Citadel, in like all different kinds of places in the game, not in the whole game, like it was always within the first couple of maps, you know. But you know, do you come up some stairs and there's the Citadel? Do you come up to a rolling door and open the rolling door and there's the Citadel? And we just tried so many different ways of revealing the Citadel. A train goes by and as you watch the train, there's the Citadel, kind of thing. And eventually we just ended up on, let's just open it up with the Citadel. Like, it's such a great view. That vista is just so powerful and totally says Half-Life. Anyway, so, you know, we kind of did that, and it's like the opening of the game, and that sort of big, you know, sweep, you know, synth sweep wash that opens the game up happened really early, and people responded really positively to it. And as we started to narrow in on what that situation was going to be, like what it is, it expanded like exponentially from basically the last 6 months to what shipped, right? So maybe there was one Strider off in the distance. Oh, there was always the Strider up close, but there wasn't always Striders in the distance. There might have been some helicopter went over pretty early on. But, you know, the drop ships that are flying around, like so much stuff got added in the last several months. And there was request for music to make it sort of this, you know, sort of foreboding, dark, dystopian feel. And as, you know, as more stuff came in, it kind of just made it more and more spectacular. But that became our focus, right? Like, so it's, and our play testers often would just stand there, right? And it could just be because of the people we chose. But so we sort of really played to that. Like, you could probably play that opening section. I mean, I know I've played it, you know, hundreds of times, and I still see new stuff. And so it was really interesting then when we launched and all the streamers are just immediately doing something instead of watching this giant, you know, vista play happen out in front of you. And we, you know, I had seen that in play testing for sure. And that's part of why we give you so. The thing is, there's always the idea was is that we wanted to present you with Half-Life. Here's this big thing. But it was, and then there was like, we want you to learn to use your hands. Because we just always, it's just like at the beginning of Portal 2, for example, we assume you don't even know how to move, right? Like that you could be brand new to VR, brand new to VR games, and we still want you to be able to function and enjoy the game. And so, you know, there's always, was always something to do, but for the most part, for a long time, it was just the radio. You know, there was the radio, you could turn the knob and kind of tune it in with the aerial, but not, you know, and so over time, though, that concept was there, but it grew exponentially to cans and bottles and a cat and a pigeon and all that stuff, right? So what we tried to do just from a mix standpoint was to still open it strong. If you really listen, the music comes in strong, but it gets out of the way pretty fast, you know? And then so you can kind of focus on all these other things. And I think there's probably, if we were to go back and redo it, we might move some other things further out of the way so that you could hear the, you know, better hear the matches in the matchbox when you shake them up next to your ear kind of thing. Which I, you know, I won't say we're super surprised, but the degree to which people really played in that playground right out the gate was not what we had been seeing as much in playtests. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, we're juggling all kinds of big sounds going on right there. And then, you know, the physics of everything were mostly handled by Roland Shaw. You know, he took on the very daunting task of recording, you know, because basically we started out 4 years ago or whatever with assets from the original Half-Life 2 and literally just playing in those maps and with those assets in VR. And so, you know, that's one of the big daunting tasks in general that we had to face was like, which assets do we keep? How much do we change them? You know, the sound in Half-Life 2 is amazing. Those assets are kind of old and some of them are pretty low resolution. And so, you know, we basically looked at all of them and, you know, in the same way that I had to figure out how to bring the music into the present and yet totally honor the sort of base of it and the fans and the nostalgia and all that. We had to do the same with every asset basically that would have existed in the past. So physics was the same. And so he had this task of sort of, you know, re-recording every bit of physics and then addressing things like smashing bottles and smashing windows and rattling a, you know, an aerosol can. So you hear the little ball inside and the matches in the matchbook box and all that stuff. So there was a ton of time put into that, but like I was saying, our tool set is super open and he developed with, you know, with the programmers, there's the in-game code. And then he arranged so that they sent, you know, his system, varying types of accelerations and sound, you know, valuable values that are happening in the game. And then he designed a whole very extensive system that sort of takes those and plays the different sounds and whatnot. And then we have a really core system. The system works as at a multi-hierarchical level. So you can have ideas that are expressed, behaviors and whatnot that are expressed in sort of the scripting. It's not a scripting language exactly. It's more like an object-oriented, you know, visual programming language kind of. And then you can then use those in bigger systems. So the things that handle things like you said, like panning or sounds being quieter at a distance, fall off, and the various forms of spatialization, including Steam Audio, which those guys came on and really just pushed. You know, we acqui-hired the Impulsonic guys a few years back. Like I said, after Emily and I had been kind of watching the industry and who was doing the most interesting work and technical work in that space and science. And so those guys came on and really honed their HRTF, which I won't go into because it's a, you know, fairly complex thing to, but basically it's the thing that makes the panning really work. You know, because honestly, panning is not how we hear things. You know, when something's to your right, yes, it is a little bit louder in your right ear, but that's not actually the thing that makes it sound like it's coming from the right side. It's this, you know, HRTF sort of filtering. Anyway, so they really dialed that in on CSGO and really sort of advanced the audio technology in our esports that way. and then brought that into what, you know, originally this all started because of VR, all the advanced binaural work and reverb simulation stuff. But then they applied it to these other titles that were existing and ongoing, where they could really iterate a lot and get a lot of feedback and really dial that in. And then they brought it, joined the HLVR team and really pushed that. And we started to dial that in. So basically, you know, we have these kind of core systems that handle how something sounds like it's coming from where it's coming from in the game. And then we have like this mountain of extensions and tools built on top of that, so that everybody's sort of getting the same features and that they're consistent under the hood. But all the different sounds and sound events and whatnot can dial those in to greater or lesser extent, if that makes sense. So that, you know, like I said, we're, you know, it's five people all sort of working and contributing at their own behest, basically. And so they're able to dial those tools in a way, or create new ones in ways that make sense for what they're doing. I don't know if I actually answered your question, but...
No, that's great. And it's always good to hear about the collaborative nature, because as a kind of like game audio nerd myself, it's something I noticed through watching, like, oh, that's giving space for that, that's giving space for that kind of thing, be it sound design or music. And I've always loved that collaborative nature that goes through Valve games and the crossover with different roles between audio.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think that's probably, you know, we just did an interview, like a written interview for an online sound design podcast thing. Blog, not podcast. And I think they asked, like, what you're the most proud of. And to me, like, pretty much unequivocally, I'd say the way the audio team, and not just the five of us, there's, you know, there's the Steam audio guys, and then Jay Stelly, who's, you know, has been with Valve forever and is one of the top programmers and handles a lot of the deep programming stuff for audio. Really gave us a lot of cool new options and toys to play with. I think we all sort of came together in a way that, you know, not only did I think that trade-off, that, because it's like I said, we don't have someone just, there's no audio lead, even though, you know, Dave Fiza did a great job in sort of handling all the sort of logistical work. You know, he was there first and really, it was the largest communicator. You know, for Valve, someone who's doing a lead job, it often involves sort of these tasks that no one else wants to do, really, you know, like a lot of communication sort of things. Anyway, he did a great job managing all that stuff. And then, like I said, his sound design was spectacular and really set the tone really early on. But you know, at the same time, everybody's kind of contributing on their own. And it was really, this team came together and made it sound, like I said, Kelly Bailey was a single person making a uniform sounding product because he did everything pretty much. Whereas, you know, here we've got a bunch of people coming together, and I feel like we managed to make it sound as cohesive as he would have done on his own, you know? And I think that, you know, it largely has to do with everybody really paying attention to each other's work. You know, usually, let's say in the past, if I show up in a scene and there's already some soundscape there or whatever, I'll check, because everybody's a musician in some capacity. I'll find what the tonal center of the soundscape is. You know, almost every soundscape has some tonal center. And then, and usually it's on pitch, right? And then oftentimes there'll even be some harmonic element. So let's say the center is a D, then I'll check, oh, it happens to be a D minor, or it's a D diminished or something, and work around that. But in this case, there was a lot more back and forth where I would kind of beam into a map and listen and go, okay, this, you know, the soundscape has got some drone that puts it sort of in an A or something. And then I would do some music that would be kind of a temp, and or, you know, maybe later on became the final thing, whatever. But it would have some sort of qualities to it. And I'd come back and then the soundscape would have been upgraded. And I'd realize that the soundscape was now kind of mimicking the music, so that they became way more integrated sounding. And it was very much like this. Everybody was iterating on their sections of on the different sections of the map and their different domains, because we kind of split up who was working on what on this project. And you know, at the end, it really made it all sound very integrated. And so that's the thing that that I like the most about sort of the sound in this game, besides the fact that we also have really great dynamic range and have really, I think, pushed some of the elements of you know, the exploration of VR pretty far.
Absolutely, yeah. But interestingly enough, we haven't actually spoken that much about your actual music side of things, because there's some really interesting stuff going on there as well.
Well, thank you.
Like, for example, one of the things that struck me earlier on in the game when I was first watching it, and it brings us back to a thing we talked about a lot in previous conversations, which is arcs, particularly in Portal 2 with the growth of different modes and things like that. And one thing that really stuck out to me was when first encountering like headcrab zombies properly for the first time, when you're interacting with them, there's this like amazing tempo-less percussive hit, like in this overall soundscape. I don't know if you remember what I'm talking about. It's like this just kind of soundscape with this overall tempo-less hit.
Okay, so there's like this sort of drum, very affected drum sound there is a tempo there, but it's actually shifting through meters through the whole thing. So it is really hard to identify what time space it's in, and it's very uncomfortable on purpose, you know. And that sort of came out of a couple different things. That whole section is super industrial sounding, and I kind of looked back at, you know, I come from a noise background, and you know, and was there for Einstürzen and Neubauten and Nurse with Wound and all of those sorts of early industrial music acts that were so extreme and really like a really great artistic period from a, you know, anti-establishment standpoint. I kind of wanted to evoke some of that just because it is your first real horror experience in the game. And it, again, kind of to me falls under one of the genres that I think the early Half-Life games evoked as well. I'm such a structuralist, as you know, from talking about Portal 2, and I kind of was looking for some structural sort of motivic concepts that I could utilize through this game that would reflect concepts of the game at a deeper level. And so one of them, you know, there's this idea, because basically all the horror elements, it's sort of like Annihilation or something, right? Like the portal's been opened, and the alien, not just an alien universe, but multiple alien universes are given this sort of doorway into our planet. And so, you know, the headcrabs and the Zen stuff and the zombies are this sort of two realities existing in the same place. And when you really look at Half-Life, that happens, that's a theme throughout, right? Because the headcrab zombies are a human that's had this sort of alien, the movie Alien-esque thing, symbiotic sort of parasite attached to them, making them into this other thing, right? So they're originally human, this alien thing, and now there's this new thing. The Combine are this species, alien species, that go into worlds and take biological or whatever, like native species to those planets, and like the Borg sort of absorb them and then make them into this other thing. So when you see those stormtrooper, you know, the actual Combine characters, they look human, but they're not. They're, you know, humans who have been absorbed and sort of borged into the Combine. So again, it's like these combining of two things into one. You know, the G-Man exists in many dimensions and times at the same time. The Vortigaunts, same thing. You know, their whole coterminous thing means they are seeing the future and the present, and the past, and all those things. Same. It's all sort of this idea of many things in one. And so, one of the things I explored a little bit, and not to the structural degree that I did in Portal 2, but was different time signatures and whatnot, sort of on top of each other and or switching back and forth in ways that are, you know, in this particular case, really uncomfortable.
Well, that's it. You say you weren't thinking of things in as necessarily the same kind of massive structural system as Portal, but this is what I noticed, particularly with this percussive thing that I was talking about there, in that there almost seem to be mini arcs across sections as those kind of pieces develop themselves across each individual section. Like that particular thing, I remember that percussive hit that to me maybe felt tempoless or hard to identify. As more things began to happen, it slowly turned into more of a beat and slowly more of something that you could pin down.
Yeah, that section is kind of one of the earlier, more interactive components that did actually survive. The original idea is, I think you get in the train and you open the door between the two train cars, and the one zombie smashes through the window on the left and the other zombie gets up and comes down the aisle at you. And it was such a powerful moment that I really, originally it was sort of this thing of like these drums were, you know, that hit you're talking about is kind of happening off in the distance on either side of you. And as the zombie gets closer to you, they kind of pan in behind the zombie and, you know, so they center, and then a low pass filter opens up, so they become stronger. That part of it, I don't think actually survived. I think I may have gotten rid of that because it was just a little too confusing. It worked better as more just like as the zombie gets closer, these other elements come in that make it more stressful. And it, originally too, the music was much, much quieter because I was trying to pull a David Lynch, you know, where you sneak it in super slowly so you don't actually notice that it's happening. And, you know, then you're interacting with this thing and there's a lot of stress. And so the music is affecting your mood, but you're not really hearing it at all. And I think it still kind of functions that way to a degree, but not like basically over time people are like, no, turn that up. we actually want to hear it. So there's some interactivity there. There is a little bit of that in the game where there are layers that turn up based on proximity to threat, basically. And that's probably what you're talking about. And then also that theme, though, sort of that motive of the zombies comes back when you go to get the shotgun, and there's sort of a sequence of events that happen that's not exactly choreo, but it is a fairly, you know, staged event where eventually three zombies come smashing through the walls all together, and you have this newly powerful weapon. And so it sort of is the culmination of that concept that starts way back when you first encounter a zombie.
Yeah, and I remember that is absolutely the moment where you say when those three crashed through, when it came back, and I thought, hang on, is that some kind of motif that's being built on here? And another one that definitely jumped out to me was like the alien spores, the alien flora seemed to come with this distant, heavily affected piano sound.
Yeah, no, that was definitely, but that one took me a long time to find. I mean, not that the mode of it was pretty straightforward because I was sort of exploring those same modes throughout the whole process. But that to get it to fit You know, Kelly Thornton was doing, along with Roland Shaw, a lot of the sounds for the Zen. Zen meaning the flora, the kind of fauna, flora stuff. And it, you know, it shows up in increasing quantities throughout the game. And it just sounded really cool. And he, one of his goals was sort of to have it be kind of naturally, like, you know, you're in this space. Again, it's these two spaces that are coexisting. You're in our reality, but then there's this other distant reality that is now sort of planted and growing in our space. And he really wanted it to feel organic and distant, yet at the same time, just naturally, or, you know, the same, it, like, you know, these two things existing together very naturally. And so I didn't really want to just go stomp on it with a bunch of music. And so it really took a while to find that sound, you know, the kind of the, that kind of distant, very affected piano playing it throughout that. I think, I don't know if in those specific moments, but that is, again, it's very related to the head crab music. And I'm using a lot of quarter tone stuff, right, which is, again, kind of conceptually between the lines. But those themes show up over and over whenever you experience the Zen, but often, you know.
And that seemed to grow to me as well. Like, you were talking about the actual growing nature of the plants, and I wonder how deliberate that was in that. I remember when you first encountered them in the game, it was just a lone piano or with some extra textures and things like that. But then later on down the line, it seemed accompanied by some equally distant, equally other dimensional, like harp, and almost like a musical saw or a theremin or something like
that. Which is also has a weird timing, if I recall. But yeah, those things definitely grow and evolve over time. And the game, you know, from basically the first moment I talked to Dave about joining the team and working on HLVR or Half-Life Alyx, he sort of had the track was not totally laid out at that point, but it was developing. And once we sort of hit on this idea of there being a vault and things getting really weird as you get near the vault, and that G-Man is in the vault. Spoilers, sorry everybody. That, you know, things get weirder towards the end there. Dave, like, immediately was like, wanted to do this thing where the soundscapes and the tone of the game started out really clean and crisp and sort of realistic. And over time got weirder and more abstract. And if you really listen to the soundscapes, that's happening, you know, by, you know, 2/3 of the way through the game, there's soundscape stuff flying around your head and with no real, diegetic sort of reason to be there. And so, you know, and by the time you get in the vault, it's just super, like, no holds barred. It's just about as weird as you can get. And so that idea plays, like, I tried to do the same thing with the music, you know, like early on, you know, the music when the alarm first goes off is pretty, you know, it's almost straight up classic film style. Although I definitely half-lifed it a bit with some synths, but, you know, it's fairly straightforward. And as time goes on, same with the Zen, it grows and changes and becomes weirder and more present and louder and more affecting, really.
Well, it's great to hear all of this because it's really soundscapey and textural, a lot of Half-Life. Because I couldn't help but when preparing for this conversation, compare it to Portal 2 from our last conversation, which I felt did have a lot more upfront themes and a lot more, even beats. I hesitate to use that because there wasn't that many upfront beats. But that does kind of lead me to some of the stuff that does break completely out of the textures, which is For me, the first time I realized when a big, like, proper traditional beat had come in was when, like, Manhacks first appear.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I was interested in the kind of equipment you're using to make these beats, because I wasn't sure to what degree they're electronic or how much you might be mixing in actual samples of playing and things like that, because I know you've got that in your history too.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I think that one in particular ended up, you know, as they say, you're, you know, with video games, you're never done. You just run out of time. And, you know, my database, you know, I had an Excel spreadsheet of work items kind of through at least the last year and a half or whatever, was, you know, over 250 items long. And I had it all color coded, like, okay, what's the most important thing for me to work on next? And I was, you know, always updating the sheet and whatnot. And that one, you know, I think ended up being more or less as it was when I first tempted into the game. Because it happens pretty quickly and it's not there for long and it's fairly effective. I did track a bunch of drums for that. So what I did is I would do it all electronically using either drum machines or MIDI patterns. I like to write my own drum patterns. I don't mind going and getting library stuff and using it, but I don't know. I wish I was a better drummer, and so I like doing it with the keyboard. I mean, actual physical drummer, you know. But I actually like to write sequences on the keyboard. And that one is also, I think that's like a truncated 7 pattern or something. Another one of those weird, like, okay, here's this timing squeezed into that timing sort of thing. But a lot of the other ones definitely would start out with, you know, generally speaking, you just don't, especially on this project, you don't know if any given sequence or map or action is going to survive or make sense to have music in it. Things were changing so often and so fast that when you kind of see an opportunity, what I do is I tend to write the smallest amount of material I can, but make sure that it's like a good pencil sketch so that it's like, this actually fits. Like, I took the time to make it fit, throw it in. And then if that sequence survives and if it still makes sense to have music in there, then I'll go back and expand it and extend it to the degree that makes sense for the game, right? And so for that purpose, I would go back and went into the studio a few times and had drummers come in and play the patterns and then play alterations on the patterns and play, you know, hi-hat and whatnot. Basically, what I was doing is, you know, if you look at the era that Kelly was writing music, and a lot of the way he did it was using sample sets, you know. And if you look at the bands that I think were probably influential to his work at the time, that's how they were doing it too, right? So you would get a, you know, a basic drum pattern and put it in a sampler and play it on, you know, literally play it on. I guess there were probably some drum pads at the time, but not many. But you just, you know, press the C key and it'd be like, and then you load in like a hi-hat on a different key and hit that, and hopefully they were in time enough. And you hear it a lot in some of those. I really like the big beat era electronic music, and I think because I come from a rock background, so that made a lot of sense to me from an electronic standpoint, sort of mixing funk and rock and the electronic sounds all together. And I think if you listen to Kelly's music, there certainly is a pretty big element of that there. And so I wanted to use that same technique. And I don't mean like using Ableton and sort of triggering loops, which is a total obvious evolution and progression from that concept, but literally making samples, looping them, and then playing them on keyboards on top of each other. Again, like I said, there are these variables. I have a list of sort of approaches that I would think that Kelly would have used that evoke sort of that style. Yes, you're right. I basically went in and recorded a bunch of drums and then made a bunch of samples. My engineer, Noah Landis, made a whole bunch of sample packages, basically, from the drums that were recorded that were based on the patterns that I sequenced, into my DAW, basically, and then laid off as loops. And that one in particular, I don't think ever fully got that treatment, but others did later on. And I think what you'll find too is that the OST, the soundtrack record, will, just like I did with Portal 2, will get the full treatment, because, you know, what works as a standalone piece of music versus something that is that you put in a game, you want more. There needs to be more detail and more interesting things to listen to when it's just a standalone piece of music. Whereas in the game, you often want less. You know, I'm definitely of the less is more mind usually, particularly in this case, in the Half-Life case. Like you said, there weren't a lot of beats. There's, you know, I've said this before, but, you know, the lead instrument in a game soundtrack is the player's mind. You know, they're solving puzzles and reacting to things going on. And so I try to not clutter that space too much, to make it too confusing. Although I do that later on in the game to pretty strong effect, just to kind of drive the stress home a bit. But,
Well, with the lion's share of the soundtrack being kind of soundscapes and textures and synths and things like that, and we've spoken about FM synthesis in the past, what kind of synths are being used? Because it certainly sounds like there is some, like, real hardware, old school stuff going on in there somewhere.
Yeah, you know, what I ended up doing, I thought about buying a bunch of hardware, but, you know, I mean, I've had electronic studios since the early, 1980, basically. And so I've had piles of keyboards and cables and all that stuff. And the current modular synth craze is pretty cool. But like I said, I end up with this giant list of tasks, and I find that hardware, unless you're just sampling it, is a real burden to when you're making that quantity of music and need to be able to go back and recreate the thing that you were doing, but change it slightly because the map has changed different or the lighting has changed or whatever. So what I ended up doing is I bought pretty much every plugin I could find, and as the new ones came out, but I really leaned towards sort of the vintage modeling packages, like the Iturias and that sort of thing. But I also got really into a lot of effects plugins, especially the ones that modeled things from, you know, so if you think about that, when this sort of is staged, I would say, from a standpoint, if this was made in the progression of the Half-Life games, it would have been like 2001 or 2002. And so I sort of was thinking, like, okay, what are the synths and tools, like I said, with the sampling and whatnot, what are the approaches that people would have been taking then, without, and, you know, in Berkeley, there's this place called the Synth Museum, and Berkeley Synthesizer Museum. Anyway, and so I went in there and spent several days recording, just screwing around, and they have everything. You know, they have a proper CS80 in there, which is, those are tens and tens of thousands of dollars at this point. They have a Fairlight. It's crazy what they have in that place. And so I spent a lot of time messing around in there. And I know my way around a bunch of those synths, but still, you know, you turn one little knob a little different and you can lose your thing and not get it back. And, you know, it's hardware synths are a whole lot of work. But what I did end up doing, so I said, like, I have all these, I used a lot of FM synth because clearly Kelly did too, a handful of other kind of vintage, but I tended to stick with the plugins and keep them in the DAW, but then I reamped almost everything. I got my hands on some hardware that I know Kelly would have had or did have, And then I, you know, bought some other sort of pedals and whatnot, and then ran, you know, I would sequence everything and then run it out through these various boxes and then through an amp and twiddle the knobs as I did it. And so it was like, okay, so I might not be able to recreate that later, but I could go back and say change the key, for example, of something, because I realized, oh, I need this to work with this other layer. I could change the key and then reamp that in a similar fashion to what I had done. I tried to keep track of all the different presets and settings and whatnot. And so that's a big component of the sound. And I think, again, if you look at that era and you listen to kind of what Kelly did, I think there was a lot of, you know, sort of post process effects. You know, it wasn't just, oh, this synth, this really pure synth sound. It was like this synth run through this distortion box and then through this flanger and then through this giant delay. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that is a huge component to that, the sound of the artists that were big at the time and Kelly's work too, you know.
Absolutely. And just to finish this up, because I wish I had more insightful conversations about VR, but it's kind of a mix of the fact that I've barely used it, and secondly, that the game is so new itself, so I feel like I haven't had that much of a chance to take it in like I did with Portal when we last spoke. So one thing I definitely wanted to ask before we finish this up was, as someone who's worked in it, what are some of the applications of VR that excite you, or that you see coming down the line, or that are only just beginning to be explored with when it comes to audio in VR?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a ton there. And like I said, the really, I'm most impressed with the work of my colleagues, you know, Dave and Roland and Kelly and Emily. Like, they really pushed some of the outer bounds of, I mean, I want to say, I'm saying outer bounds, but really at the end of the day, like, you know, it's sound. So you want it to really fit and work in the context of the game. And VR is more real than anything else, any other medium we have, more real as in more similar to our everyday sort of perceptual experience. And so I think there's an aspect to pushing the envelope, which is not pushing the envelope and just making it work at all and making it feel like it's actually right. And that when you throw that bottle and it smashes against the building, that it's coming from the place you're hearing it come from the place you're seeing, and it's sounding like you would expect it to sound, is a huge success just in and of itself. But then, you know, some of the more abstract exploration that Dave did with moving sounds and you know, there's a lot, there's an insane amount of work that went into sort of combining that concept of like, okay, the sound's coming from over here, but then there's this other, like the tail of the sound, because all of a sudden, instead of just left and right, you have left, right, up, down, forwards, backwards, right? And there's a lot of work that those guys did where the sound, you might have a certain percentage of the sound or certain layers of the sound are coming from a really detailed location. And then the tail is actually coming from behind you, right? Or from a vector that's orthogonal to your viewpoint. And so if the sound's in front of you, the tail is coming from behind you, or if the sound's to your right, the tail is to your left. That kind of combination of exploring the not just the singular sound, but all the elements of sound and sound design and how you can play with all of these new directionalities that we have control over. I think that it was super fascinating, and they really pushed that a lot. I really got into exploring sort of scale a bit, and it wasn't something that I did necessarily on purpose, but there's this giant droning energy, you know, this sub, we call a substation, basically, where the combine are extracting vort energy from the Vortigaunts through these little prisoner pods, which you're probably familiar with from the other Half-Life games. But they're sort of extracting their chant energy into these things and then resonating it and concentrating that energy and then sending it up these cables to the vault that's holding the prisoner. And so it's this giant, it's kind of like standing next to a giant power station, you know, and the cables are, they go up high, probably 50 feet above you. There's five of them. And I really wanted, it was sort of a long evolution that I want to explain how that came to be, but they kind of resonate in this way that is this ambient music, right? And there's these fingers that that stretch the cables and make it kind of this ambient dance of tonality, because again, the energy is being extracted from the vorts who are chanting. And when I first set it up, I was like, oh, well, you kind of, whenever you do this spatialized audio stuff, you know, the first thought is, well, I could just play a single sound from right there. But in VR, you're so aware of the location of sounds and where they're coming from. And, you know, cause your inner ear is, you know, the key to good VR visuals is that your inner ear matches what you see down to this like really microsecond level, right? The latency is very low. And that way your inner ear matches your eyeballs. And that's what makes it feel so real. It also, when it's not good, is what also makes people barf. But that same idea extends to your actual ears. So your inner ear is telling your brain what angle your ears are pointing, and your actual ears are hearing where the sound is coming from. And so you can really identify the locations of things in a better fashion. And so what I ended up doing just as an experiment is I put these droning sounds, separate droning sounds, on each of the kind of origin of these cables. And you know, it's really tall, and then sort of tuned them up so that you could hear the full set of them. And it just suddenly, when I first tested it, it was extraordinary, because as you crane your head up, your ear changes angles. So your inner ear is telling your brain that you're looking upwards, but your actual ear is now hearing the sounds differently as they go higher up the set of cables. And it just makes it sound huge in a way that normally when you say, you know, if you're doing sound design and in, let's say, a linear format or even in a game, you know, the idea of making something sound huge usually involves like pre-delay and some delay and some reverb and volume, right? And certain types of EQ tricks and maybe some side chaining to compressors or whatever. But in this case, it's like, it's loud, sure, it's loud, but as you move your head to look up, the sound changes as if it were a large sound. And that to me is absolutely fascinating. Like, you can't do that in any other context, really. And so I think that is, you know, and then like shaking the little box of matches, you know, the equal opposite is like these teeny little sounds, which is harder to do HRTF for things really close to your head. But, you know, those are kind of obvious, you know, this is first go around. So, you know, even just exploring those obvious things of scale is huge. It's really fascinating and kind of a new Wild West in some ways, you know.
Yeah, and those are exactly the kind of things that I imagine as someone who hasn't barely dipped his toe into this kind of thing. I imagine that kind of thing, and I can't wait to see this evolve and for me to actually get my headset and encounter these things myself.
Yeah, I, you know, also, like I said, even with the music, I was very careful. I went into it very, from an implementation standpoint, really aggressive, because Dave was doing all these super cool implementations, and you know, my background is in sort of very interactive, very spatialized implementation, and so I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. But as I sort of got into it, like I said, it was more like, oh, what I really want to do is nail down the basics, you know, and really kind of, and then explore in a handful of places. And so I think, you know, as people become more familiar with the vocabulary of VR, then we'll be able to push the boundaries of it a bit more, you know. And as those boundaries extend and people's vocabulary around the art form expand, you know, there'll be some crazy new things that'll happen that no one will have done before. And that is really exciting. But I think, you know, across the board on this game, we were trying to identify and really just nail down the things that VR is great at and that are obvious, as opposed to really, really pushing the outside edges of things and experiment too much, you know, which again will happen. It's you got to take one step at a time.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, it's just got me thinking for the first time how it might be to pop your head through a portal in VR. That's got to be a strange experience.
Oh, I mean, you know, God, I went through so much work on Portal 2 just making it so that you could have specific sounds come from two different spaces at the same time, you know, and that was just in a WASD 2D scenario, you know. I think it'll be really cool. I mean, it's so funny, this came up in an email thread at work just the other day. Dave Fiza's work in soundscape transitions, which is a weird tall like game sound designer nerd thing to think about, but is just like freaking peak. It's just like pure artwork. Like, it's just a pure piece of art. Like, he made these things where, like, you can stand in a room and open and close a window, and the soundscape from outside and inside just like transitions. It's not like you're going inside and outside, like the outside soundscape is coming through the window to you. And as you move through spaces and like corridors and doorways and whatnot, like it, and it's again, one of those things that, you know, you'll never notice, because that's the whole point, is that it's supposed to just sound like it should sound. But to a sound nerd, it's really spectacular, like really, really amazing, amazing work.
Absolutely. And Half-Life Alyx is a real playground for that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So thanks for speaking to me again about that, Mike. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty more we could talk about, as always. So just keep going for hours on this kind of thing.
I know. I can, you know me, I can talk forever. Well, you know, maybe once the soundtrack's out, we can talk again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we'll help promote that for sure. And I'll hopefully have been able to actually play the damn thing by then.
Hey, you know, it does actually play quite well on all the different headsets. You don't have to have an Index. I think it's probably more important to make sure you have a decent video card. But, you know, this system... You know, you'll get, your textures will be a little lower resolution depending on your card and your system. I tested it on the Vive. You know, I mean, obviously I gave my Vives away at this point, but I've had multiple Vives and all the different iterations of the prototype indexes or indices. I don't even know how we say that, but you know, playing it on the original Vive, especially if you have the sort of upgraded premium head strap, is a great experience. It's, you know, it's not as good as the Index, obviously, with the Hummingbirds, but, you know, or get to use your own headphones. But the Vive is, I don't know, the original Vive holds up for me. I prefer it over the Oculus Gear, just because I really like the crisp concrete or really solid nature of the tracking.
As you've said, is so important in supporting you into that world.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, well, we'll definitely catch up again in the future, and any other projects that ever come up, you know, the show's always here.
Yeah, I enjoy listening to it, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem, Mike. Right, so we'll catch up again in the future.
Sure thing. Stay safe, healthy and sane.
Yeah, same to you, man.